You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Thanks to all of you for I know we have two competing brown bags today, so thanks to all of you for joining us. I was just recently thinking that it might be because of the shared framework around post-2015 that we're doing, or because of UNGA last week, UN General Assembly, or the fact that things in fiscal governance are really beginning to kick off with a bunch of new staffers within the program, myself included. It feels like there's a lot happening around transparency, accountability, and participation issues, both inside and outside the foundation, so really think that this is a timely conversation. Quite a bit going on, of course, with Open Government Partnership, with work that we're all doing, with work that we're also doing to support making all voices count around closing the citizen feedback loop. Targeting both, looking at transparency and accountability issues, both from the government, the public sector perspective, also the citizens' perspective. And so this interface, this conversation that we'll have with Prashant today, I think will be just taking that forward and clarifying some of those questions that we're teasing out through the other work that we're doing. So we're also sort of across the field at a time when there's a constantly growing body of work in the transparency and accountability and governance field, and an evidence base that can help us better understand what works, how, in what context. And I think against this backdrop, we're really fortunate to have OSF fellow Prashant Sharma contributing to this body of literature by looking at transparency and accountability vis-a-vis a somewhat distinct beast or animal, whatever you want to call it, the public-private partnership, and one that we know is increasingly involved in work that is still seen as predominantly sort of the domain of the public sector, and that is social service provision. So we're looking forward to staying in touch with Prashant around the research that he'll be endeavoring to do over the next year. I know that today's chat focuses a bit more sort of on the, not just looking at transparency, accountability, and governance through the lens of public-private partnerships, but taking it a step sort of back and looking at the intervention of right to information laws, particularly in the case of India. So I know you'll lead us in a discussion of RTI and its impact around sort of transparency and accountability and governance outcomes, but also around the sort of unintended outcomes that this generates and what does that mean for the work that we do. A lot also in the field going on with respect to this work in a complementary fashion with work being done by, of course, folks within the foundation, but also Jonathan Fox doing a bit of research around social accountability, what that looks for in this space, basically complicating the assumption that transparency automatically leads to accountability and that it's sort of an end to itself, onto itself. So I know that the brown bag invitation noted that context doesn't just matter, but also very specifically impacts how these interventions play out in reality. So I don't want to spend more time setting up the discussion. I know we want to get to get to Prashant and also get to the questions and the discussion post. So would love to hand it over to Prashant, and I know your bio is attached. Everyone can take a look, but very, very excited to have you be part of this conversation and take this forward.
Thank you. I think you pretty much covered everything. I have nothing more to say. But it's really wonderful to be here. It's great. It's quite a bit of interest around this, and I think it's quite. If some of you are in the field may have noticed that about 2 weeks ago something, Paraguay became the 100th country in the world to have a freedom of information law. Now, of course, that means there's 100 countries to have this particular kind of thing. And all of this has happened really in the last two decades or so. Up to 1990, there were only about 8 countries in the world which had any kind of freedom of information law. And suddenly in the last two decades, this thing has, just skyrocketed. So it's quite an interesting phenomenon. I still feel it's terribly under-researched. Considering the kind of scale at which it's going on, it's happening. But at the same time, it's So to my mind, I mean, it's interesting. Why does it, of course, there's a larger global politics around it, of course, why is it all happening around this time, and suddenly there's a global interest. But what cannot be denied is that there is a lot of global interest in this area of transparency, accountability, one of the manifestations of which being right to information or freedom of information or access to information laws, whatever is the preferred form of describing it. So given that, I mean, a lot of my own work has been focused, of course, on the Indian thing. And in many ways, it's also interesting that one of the, that India is considered to be one of the leaders globally in terms of access to information, both in terms of the content of its legislation, which is considered to be very, very progressive within the world of freedom of information laws, and also in terms of implementation, particularly at the federal government level, which has been fairly good given the resource limitations of the state, and also most importantly extremely popular. So for example, I'm sure, well, in India, of course, numbers is always the big thing. So but by some estimates, I think there were something like 3 or 4 million access to information requests in 2013. So there are all these huge numbers, and there's, of course, the state seems to be responding fairly well, and so on and so forth. Now, of course, all of this is very exciting, and in many cases, there have been documented instances of this exposure of a lot of corruption. So in that sense, the whole purpose, the larger political purpose of, you know, why should there be access to information law, why should there be more openness in government, basically to curb corruption, of course, and to also ensure greater accountability of the state to its citizens, and also in terms of, at the more political level, have the whole notion of the principal agent, that relationship being resolved a bit more in the direction of the citizens themselves. So that's been it's been very exciting. There has been a lot of excitement around it. And of course, like I said, many large-scale corruption, sort of instances of corruption, government corruption, have come to light as a result of using, as a direct result, apart from many other things, and an activist court and so on and so forth, to light. So it's been doing many things for what it's supposed to, you know, what we are rightly excited about. I mean, the potential of this kind of legislation, this kind of framework to actually hold the state to account in a more daily basis, not just the five-year elections and not just the whole other larger, you know, political frameworks in which we normally see accountability playing itself out. But there's also been, I mean, at least in the Indian case, I can say this for sure, and I believe, I think we could extend this to not just other countries, other non-OECD countries, but I think generally across the board, pretty much across wherever these 100 countries are, where there are some sort of freedom of information laws, which is the general discourse around which just seems to play itself out. It's doing some good things. Of course, it's doing things which we are passionate about, anti-corruption and so on and so forth. But very often the discourse seems to suggest that, yes, of course, this, look, we told you so. Now that we have the RTI, we now know that the state is corrupt, it's inefficient, it's venal, it's arbitrary, and it is wasteful, and so on and so forth, which is good. I mean, of course, that's a very important outcome of this. But at the same time, invariably, the discourse seems to end. When I say discourse, of course, I mean public media, opinion makers, the general articles, the general writing, which is in the public domain, also to a large extent within academic literature as well. So there is that there is this great excitement around the potential with evidence and so on and so forth, but it tends to stop there. It doesn't sort of go on to say that, you know, yes, of course, the state is corrupt and venal and or can be, and have huge limitations and so on and so forth. But that sort of, in a very indirect manner, feeds into another discourse, which is, at least particularly in India, has been becoming very popular, of the whole thing of privatization, minimizing government, having a very lean, mean state, the state sort of retreating from its traditional functions, and whether it's through models like outsourcing, whether it's through models like other, you know, public-private partnerships, which we could speak about a little bit more later. So there is this whole thing. There is the larger discourse around the whole economic liberalization and, you know, markets versus the state. And it is a versus thing, particularly right now. It's not necessarily in partnership with, although the rhetoric is beginning to change a bit. The energy in some ways the more, it's almost a, it's a counterintuitive thing, the more we prove through elements of transparency and accountability that the state is corrupt, the more we also strengthen the general other discourse which says, yes, of course, we always said the state is inefficient and corrupt, therefore we must privatize, therefore we must outsource, therefore we must get other entities which are non-state in nature to perform those kind of traditional public functions, whether it's education, health, electricity, water supply, sanitation, all of these things. There's more and more a much greater push and a greater drive towards that. And this sort of discourse sort of almost speak in, not necessarily consciously, but speak in tandem with each other, almost complementing each other. Now, this is, of course, I mean, there's nothing inherently good or bad in any of these things, of course. But the question is, when these things are happening, as these shifts are taking place, we have put in place greater, more stringent mechanisms for the state to be obliged to be more accountable and transparent. Yes, whether it's freedom of information laws, whether it's greater proactive dissemination of information, how it works, what it does and doesn't do, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, the same kind of standards of accountability which we now consider to be the norm when it comes to public authorities and state-owned state entities, the same kind of norms are not being also at the same time transferred on to these other kind of entities which are performing services of a public nature. So one way to see it is just as a coincidence. Another way to see it is possibly as a conspiracy. I'm probably not going to necessarily take a position on that at this point. But it seems rather convenient that just as that we have this whole sort of rush and thing of everybody getting onto the freedom of information bandwagon, as it were, just at the state, at the same time when the state is also retreating from its traditional functions. So what is going on here? Is it a larger political project? Is it sort of being designed? What kind of forces are at work? Why is this happening? And are there ways in which one could possibly extend the kinds of norms and standards which we like to now extend to the state, and which the state has, if you look at any of these larger global entities, open government partnership, there's a lot of excitement around that. There's of course the RTI rating indexes, and there's all kinds of other activity around, but all of them are focused on the state. There's nothing which really speaks about private or hybrid entities. So how is it that they're sort of, are we looking at a case of, locking the stable doors when the horse is bolted? Are we getting all excited? Or in Hindi, I mean, there's a nice phrase which is "Bhagte bhoot ki langoti sahi," which is, so there's you, well, it's difficult to translate. Maybe we can do that later. Fozia will help me with that.
Not on that one.
For me, it's just a peculiar thing. It's something which needs greater investigation. And while I think it's important to be excited about freedom of information, right to information, access to information, accountability, transparency, and all of these things, but I mean, the ideas are critical and extremely important, particularly in the context of the whole, when we talk about enriching and essentially deepening democracy, these ideas are critical to it, of course. But at the same time, if the nature of the state itself is changing, and the things that it's doing and the things that it's expected to do, if that's undergoing a radical shift, then perhaps these ideas and this lens also needs to be broadened to incorporate other kinds of entities which are performing traditionally what could be considered as state functions or public functions or delivering public goods and services, and incorporate that. Now, what those forms would take, are there some forms already which exist? I'm not so sure, because typically hybrid entities or private entities see the relationship with as it's a more of a client or a consumer relationship. But with the state, it's a political relationship. The state citizen, it's a citizenship issue really at stake here, and which is at the heart of it. So from that perspective, I find that, anybody and everybody, I think, who's sort of working on some of these issues, we need to start broadening and saying, okay, in what forms I doubt if it's going to be realistically possible in the next 15 years to actually start having the same kind of obligations or norms extended to private or hybrid entities. But there are surely ways which could be explored whereby similar kinds of obligations could be extended. They could be legal in nature, there could be a greater public interest around, there could be greater demands. We don't know. I mean, at this point, I don't know of too many examples which actually do this well or successfully. So that's sort of broadly, I mean, the South African law is a very progressive one, which of course, the access to information law there, which does suggest that all entities which a citizen can essentially access information from when there is a question of any rights of the citizen involved, from any kind of entity. But that becomes an implementation nightmare. So obviously it has not really played itself out well. It's very progressive in its thinking, in its politics. But there are practical things like, I mean, you, for example, could we consider specific clauses which say that any entity which performs any kind of public services must be within the ambit of such laws? Could we introduce a clause which says in any entity where the governance structure incorporates government appointees as a part of that, they must therefore be part of such things. So there are ways of which finding that, of course, the law part of it is just one small part of it. But the idea generally is that how can we ensure or try and make sure that just because even at the nature of the state changes, how do we ensure that our focus around accountability and transparency and our energies incorporates these other kind of entities. And essentially it's holding power to account. And power may lie with the state, or used to lie definitely in the Indian context 20 years ago very much with the state, but the location of power is shifting and has shifted a lot more towards other entities, towards the market, towards private entities and so on and so forth. So wherever it's a question of public interest in hand, in what forms and ways can we hold power to account rather than government to account? Because government may not be the only location of power, the exclusive location of power anymore. So that's sort of the broad framework, and I think it'll be perhaps this is, you think it's a good time to open it up for a discussion, because I'd much rather have a discussion than all four.
Sure, so maybe we could hand it over to Subarna if there's any initial questions you want to
ask. I mean, thank you, Prashant. The only sort of one question I was thinking about when sort of reading through just very initially some materials was what you think, or some initial thoughts even the group might have around what the role of civil society might have vis-a-vis this sort of changing context in which transparency and accountability plays out. And so if there are any thoughts that you have around that, I thought might be interesting to think about.
Well, I mean, the first instance, I think just to think about this question is already very important.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a lot of energy, either intellectual or through programmatic work, which is, you know, directed in this area of questioning the role of hybrid entities from an accountability perspective. There is a lot of work and there's a lot of interest in research work as well around entities such as public-private partnerships, but most of it is coming either from the economics fields discipline or from the law discipline. Now, the economists are essentially very interested in ideas of efficiency. Is it really good value for money? Better return on investment and so on and so forth, which is, of course, fair enough. It's valid. It's a valid question to have. The lawyers are mostly interested in how is the risk distribution organized, what kind of arrangements, legal contractual arrangements are there, what is more interesting, how does it work with the larger legal framework. So there's all this contractual arrangements is where I think a lot of legal energy is coming from. But from the political perspective, there's very little questioning which is going on around it from, again, I repeat, the accountability perspective. There's a lot of stuff around political economy. In the sense, yes, the state is privatizing, and should that be, is that a good thing? Now, that question is important, but the point is it is happening, and when we talk about things and these kind of these processes from an accountability and a transparency lens, that energy is not there. I mean, there's a lot of interest, but there's not any either focused work, or most of the time, most of the energies of civil society organizations or entities are essentially, the mindset is that it's the state. It's, if you just have a conversation, it's always thought of as transparency of the state, accountability of the state. And I think that shift in thinking is essential. It's not just the state. It's about accountability of wherever, whatever kind of entity it may be, which is affecting the lives of people at vast scales. And that thinking, I think that switch, until that switch, or at least a greater interest, widening of that thing, of the lens, of the perspective, I think that is essential. And OSF is probably a great place to, would be an entity which starts talking about some of these things in a more structured, in a more focused manner. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say.
And I wonder if that's something where I know there's a natural sort of work that the public health program does around sort of engaging, particularly around sort of end user, but service provision at the health, on health services, a very sort of an easy to understand and easy because the impacts are so great on the person, the individual, the family itself. But that's, for me, an easy way to think about how do we sort of get civil society and citizens even to think about these and engage in these discussions. But wanted to open it up for others to have questions, comments.
I had a Gladys. Yeah, thank you.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Gladys. I work for the Youth Exchange. I was thinking a little bit on the conspiracies side of things, and wondering what the funding landscape in India looks like for the organizations that are doing this sort of work, and whether you found any correlations between the discourse that you described and sort of the agenda that's being espoused by funders.
I mean, in terms of funding, I mean, it's not as, I won't say that, first and foremost, there's, I don't know of any organization which is actually working on the transparency and accountability question within the context of public-private partnerships. I don't know that. So I don't think there is any concentrated energy, which is, I think, part of the problem. The whole civil society, NGO sector and everything, in any case, I think is right now probably undergoing some sort of a great change and churning and transition with the new government. So I think I think new lines are being drawn, new modes of engagement are being created. I won't say it's better or worse at this point, it's just that it's going to be very different than it used to be in the last 10 years. That is for sure. Because in the last 10 years, the previous government definitely, I mean, civil society leaders were very closely embedded within government at a very high political level. So there was that, there was definitely that. But now I think that's going to undergo a change. The forms will, I mean, the larger structures might remain somewhat similar, but the forms, I think, the modes, forms of engagement, what the role of these entities is imagined as, I think that is going to have to change. About the conspiracy part, I mean, you see, what I also argued during my book, which is coming out, in fact, next week, and that came out of my doctoral dissertation, that it's not so much a question of and I could say this for India, I think it would be partly true for many other countries which enacted these transparency laws in any case, is that this whole rise, I mean, of access to information and transparency in the last 20 years is also part of a much larger shift in the geopolitics. The end of the Cold War, I mean, prior to that was an essential element in the whole story. Why was it that transparency and accountability was not such a big deal prior to 1919, any of the larger international governance institutions? Why was the World Bank not interested in the state before 1991? Why weren't we talking about the role of the state? Because there was a Cold War. I mean, why wasn't the conditionality of aid before 1991? Because there was a Cold War. If you put in too many conditionality, we go off to the other side. So there was that sort of thing. I mean, this is a very simplified, but there is a larger forces at work in some ways. Once the Cold War ends, I mean, there is the whole thing of good governance becomes a very important idea. It happens at that time. It doesn't happen before. The whole thing of, accountability, democratization, what's being called the third wave of democratization takes place. One of the ways to prove you're more democratic is to also have a laws like access to information, that becomes, you know, a very nice little thing to say, look, we just enacted this kind of a law, we are well on our path to democratization, particularly in the former Soviet republics. And that's where the numbers spike as well. You start seeing the pattern when you start seeing who's enacting transparency laws around what time. So there is this global thing, and that's also around the time when, again, the recalibration or rethinking of what the market should do vis-a-vis the state, that starts taking place around the same time. Coincidentally, or not, maybe not so coincidentally, in the Indian context, 1991 is the time when the economic liberalization project starts taking off. There are other reasons which are more complicated and more specific to India, which I won't want to go into right now, why this idea became sort of popular at this particular time. But it's just that this is around the time when the larger global imagination of what the state can or cannot do starts changing. And that is also around the same time, globally, where access to information and transparency become really, and accountability become these big things. So, and there is a correlation, and I think, as one of my respondents had once put it, I thought, so what is it, and why does it happen at the same time? And he didn't put it like this, but my take out was it's climate change. And of course, climate change being, in a sense, the time was right. It was a climate in that sense. It was the timing was right. Things were coming together in a certain way in terms of larger global forces at work, which came together and ensured that this idea became an idea which did not necessarily also in a very fundamental way disturb status quo. And in terms of where power lies and so on and so forth, it wasn't shaking that up to a great extent. And where it was, that it would be defanged in a certain way. So you would have the law, but you'd have a very, you know, sad kind of a law, let's say, whatever, or the other processes would not allow it to flower or grow in the same manner, or become popular in the same manner, or be used in the same manner. So I think there is these largest forces at work, and I think those are forces to be recognized. So whether somebody is sitting, you know, on what might be the second tallest building in New York across the thing, and the top, and they say, oh, I will now confabulate with my people and come up with a little conspiracy, it's not probably quite like that, but forces and energies do come together, do push. That's again coming back to the same thing, that the efficiency principle, all of these ideas are, they work together, they overlap, they support each other at one level, they do not at another level. And I think we have to be careful about what are the ideas that are important, and continue to push for those ideas regardless of who the actors are, because the actors do change, and the forms those actors take does change. So I think, does that sort of answer your question?
Yeah.
I think Sanjay and then Vinay.
So 18 months ago, when there was a lot of discussion about the Lokpal and basically an ombudsman's office, to look at issues of corruption, there was a lot of discussion at that time also about corporate corruption. And it flowed from the Wadia tapes, where it was sort of gleaned that corporate individuals were approaching journalists to influence public policy and just paying for this privilege, etc. So there was a lot of discussion about corporate corruption at that time. I'm just curious whether, since that 18-month, sort of the time between now and then, has there been more of a conversation in India about these issues? Because you mentioned in your initial portion that it hasn't really, at least with PPPs, translated. I'm just wondering whether that conversation essentially died at that time or shortly thereafter, or if there's been a continued exploration of how do you hold corporates accountable for the corruption they may engage in.
No, I don't think it's died. It definitely, I think, has had a dip. But it's because I still feel that the main energy remains, corruption is always on in the larger public imagination. It remains within the domain of the state. The state is the essence, the focus of all. I mean, that's where corruption exists, that's where corruption lies, and that must be focused on. And I think to a large extent also because that's how it's reported. At the same time, I think the consciousness is changing, and I think people generally, particularly in India, I think becoming more and more impatient. I think the impatience is very palpable. Not just the state in terms of the political, or rather the executive, but also the impatience with, let's say, corruption in the judiciary. So other entities which were generally considered to be not within the radar, within the public radar, in the sense of imagination of so or sites of corruption or spaces of corruption, that's coming in. And definitely now the corporates as well, particularly around these large infrastructure, especially or natural resource extraction. So the whole thing around Coalgate. I mean, the whole coal mining thing. I mean, for those of you who don't know, it's interesting. So have a look at it on your sort of Google it or something. But and the complicity, or in the 4G, the telecom spectrum scams and so on and so forth. I think so. The fact that corporates are involved, I think that's generally speaking, people of course know that essentially big money comes from corporates. Yes, that's where. But the responsibility. Where the responsibility for fixing it lies, that still, I think, currently is imagined, it lies at the state and with the state which must do something about it. I would say, but to what extent corporates must be held directly accountable, yes, that should be, but if the state didn't allow it to happen, it wouldn't happen. I think that's the general sense. But again, like I said, I think that's changing. So now, for example, with the last couple of judgments of the Supreme Court, which in fact annulled all the 281 coal blocks which had been allocated since 1993, along with fines upon the corporates per ton kind of a thing for indulging indirectly in that kind of process of coal block allocation, that's been quite big. The fact that, although despite the new government is supposed to be very close to corporate interests and so on and so forth, at the same time, Reliance, which is of course the biggest corporate entity in India, the fact that they were fined $4 billion around the whole thing of not essentially fulfilling the contractual obligations to extract after being allocated this particular basin for oil and natural gas. So there are these things which are there which seem to suggest that not only the courts but the government is also at least wants to be seen to be working in the public interest in terms of these large scale shall we say, arrangements. And it's, but I think again, that's the other thing. I think a lot of the energy is also shifting, both in terms of practice as well as interest, from petty corruption to grand corruption. So yes, of course, the concern of the cop on the streets taking 100 rupees is one thing, but I think, which is important and people are concerned about it, and that is, but I think at the political level, the ways in which corruption took place or the ways are in that sense, I think we are emulating these parts of the world. This is where, I mean, grand corruption is very well organized. It's organized, whether it's here or in Western Europe, where you won't find much petty corruption, but it operates at a scale which is so large that it's almost invisible, becomes invisible. So I think in that sense, we are moving along in that direction. Whether it's a good thing or a bad thing is another question, but it's just that that's something which needs to be kept in mind.
Prashant, so I sort of coming from perspective of both a practitioner who was involved in right to information and right to health struggle, especially working in India about 5 to 6 years back, and also now having worked in OSF for about 4 years, and supporting mostly what we call social accountability mechanisms around health service delivery, which is, as you say, sort of like an extension of right to information to transparency and accountability of service delivery. And as much as you say, you did mention the public-private partnerships as being a contested space and a contested idea. I think also to take a judgment call on that, for us as public health program, we have maintained that health services is people's rights, and it is the public domain and it is the public responsibility, the state responsibility to be able to respond to those. And if you look at various ways in which, because of the social accountability sort of gaining more political currency and more civil society getting organized, at least I can say from our own experience in certain states in India, that the civil society had to change the course of which how it was engaging with the government. Only through the lens of accountability, when it was mostly the confrontational mode of saying that state is failing to provide its services, which was then verified through the community processes, it was easier for the state to then say, one, that we do not have as adequate control as much as we would like to have, and that we are not able to deliver this. So why not we then privatize these services? And that has become a real danger of even the state minister sort of using those arguments and the industry using those arguments to push for privatization, which you really sort of brought out in your issue. So one of the ways of which I would say practitioners have tried to engage with it, but it's not come out in the global literature that when we read about, which usually comes from the institutions like IDS or any of these sort of big institutions, is the success is defined by, okay, the funders say that the success is defined by the OPD services increasing by 50% to 60%, outpatient services, but not looking at 5 to 10 years of sort of like a lens, through the political lens of how it is sort of affecting the larger political and policy climate in that. So what they're also missing is that a lot of civil society are rooting their social accountability issues within the broader struggle. So if I have to say, right to health care is the sort of the broader concept under which the social accountability is rooted, and not social accountability for accountability itself. And that is one conversation that I think is sort of missing within the larger broader space that we get engaged in. And what is also happening is, as much as you speak of petty corruption, this sort of social accountability mechanisms, we have found it easier to hold the small people, like a village health worker working at the village level or a doctor working at the primary health care level, to say both for the corruption that they are doing, but at the same time we do not speak of systemic failures. Everything that is wrong within that particular service delivery point is then put on to the person who is responsible there, and never holding the higher authorities, which are like the state level or the national level, which are supposed to be doing both policies and implementing those policies in a systematic fashion. So I think that is sort of the gap that we are missing in this entire debate of social accountability and right to information. So how do we then sort of look at those issues moving forward, I think would be one important thing. But for me, I'm also sort of interested from your point of view, because we sit in a funder space and we have sort of a macro picture and not engage in day-to-day sort of how this plays out in the field, both of the public servants, who now a lot of people don't want to even join public service. As much as the state is withdrawing, people is like, oh, I don't want to go and produce 18 reports every week and then get to hear like people screaming at me for no mistake of mine. How much of you of this you think is also being perpetuated by the which the knowledge is constructed? Again, from the perspective of somebody sitting, as you said, in the second tallest building in New York, or the researchers coming from outside and sort of extracting information? And how much of it is also about a honest conversation, or more sort of a, I would say, more spaces for day-to-day practitioners to interact with the big funders and with the big program? How much of it is being missed, and how much of it can be promoted? So,
well, it's a huge, I mean, it's a huge question. You know, the politics of knowledge, we could keep discussing that, and the politics of knowledge production, we could discuss that till the end of our days, really, and still not be able to come to any conclusions. It's absolutely right. I mean, most of the knowledge production, the ideas, particularly informs that is that particular set. I mean, you see, it's not necessarily located physically anymore in these parts of the world, but it's a particular vocabulary, and it's a particular language, and it's a particular form of knowledge production, which essentially exists across the globe, but within a certain narrow band of elites. Now, I mean, that is a fundamental problem. Elite interests in many ways are, in that broader sense, are in sync with each other. I mean, it could be in just in terms of being relevant. Essentially, from a civil society perspective, it means continuing to be in the news, continuing to be relevant, continuing to speak the things and be heard, saying things and being heard. So it operates in very different manners. But the vocabulary and that form, it is a classic, can the subaltern speak? Can the subaltern have a voice in any form? We don't, I mean, it's very clear, you know, it's very difficult. There will always be mediators. And who will be being the mediating at the global level between funders and between big NGOs and between intergovernmental organizations? Yes, of course, I mean, there will be some platforms, but most of the time it is it is sort of lip service a lot of the time. And as to be, again, you know, it's not as if people don't understand or realize it. The one of the people in the West during my research work, when I was speaking to the person, he was one of the village level workers of this particular entity, which was had been pushing for the whole RTI, part of the whole movement and everything. And he said a very simple thing. You know, we were having long conversations about the politics and so on and so forth. And he said a very simple thing. He said, "Yeah, Prashant, it's all a game of English." Now, when he says, and of course he said this to me in Hindi, "Angreji ka khel hai yaar, pata hai, sabko pata hai." You know, that kind of a thing. So it's not that, people are, you know, this whole thing, it's not that people don't have agency and all the rest of it. Because obviously he knows how the system works, but he's also working it in the best way possible given his skills. But at the same time, he's not going to be directly involved in these conversations which happen at this level. Now, from a funder's perspective, I don't know, it's a challenge. How does one ensure that the ideas at the very least are not being generated here? The ideas can be discussed, but the generation of ideas must, and to be able to tap into the generation of ideas, which is happening in a much more diffused, disorganized and vernacular form, which are relevant and appropriate, but be able to tap into those ideas, tap into those thoughts without our own preconceived narrow band limitations of looking at the world. Not always even seeing ourselves as translators or mediators, but seeing just literally as maybe just megaphones or something like that. I don't know. It's a very complex thing, and it's one of the most difficult things. I mean, if it was simple, it would have been done already. But it's not. Because certain things happen only because form structures are designed in that fashion. We can have a UNG and we can have a tribal person coming and giving a speech in the UNGA, but everybody feels good about it. Sure, of course everybody feels good about it, including the person who's coming from there, and that will be a big splash in the news for a little while. Some of those ideas will get percolated, will trickle down in some ways, some forms. But the space of knowledge generation is essentially a very, very political space. And the first thing is self-awareness is the first thing, the individual level, of course, as well as institutional. And then see what forms. And it could be a mirror. It could work for a little while. It may after that morph into something else. I think one of the limitations when we look at things institutionally is always we think about scaling up. We want to scale up. Maybe scaling up is not the solution. Maybe something works only at that particular level. Let's just support that and see where it goes. It's because an idea works in one particular context doesn't mean it has to work either at the mid-level or at the macro level, or for that matter the same idea. And we always say, yes, of course, lessons learned and all these things are important, not that they aren't, of course. But at the back of the mind of the lesson learned is always continues to be, how can we then take this idea and put it somewhere else? So I think it's, because that becomes the value addition of our role, so we have to justify our role in it. We are, in the end, essentially, we are all middlemen. So if we're all middlemen, then how are we going to justify our role? What value addition are we bringing? So if we are not willing to do that, if we are willing to at some point say, look, maybe there could be another definition of our role. What it could be, I mean, that's to be, I think, to be discussed, thought about in different ways. But it's not that it doesn't happen. I'm sure whether it's in OSF, in other places, it happens, but it happens in, it's not the main way of being, is not essential to that way of being of that institution, usually, of most institutions we work in this process of production, dissemination of knowledge in the larger developmental space.
Hi, my name is Mark Krupansky, I'm with the Justice Initiative. And my question is a tactical one around the use of rights information. And the challenge around holding private power to account when they're designed not to really be held publicly accountable beyond their stockbrokers. Of course, then you mentioned one of the ways they are supposed to be held accountable is through the state, and the state's often complicit in this move from public to private. So my question is, how effective have you seen right to information efforts targeted to the state around contracts with private entities or oversight of private entities? Has that been an effective proxy to hold private power to account or not?
Hardly any. Partly also because, I mean, since it's a very specific question, the answer would be specific in the sense that In the Indian context, for example, there is a clause which says that Section 2F of the law, which essentially says that any citizen can actually get any information held by the government through any other legislation in force. The government obviously holds a lot of information about private entities, whether it's through, you know, whether it's through your revenue records and whether it's through your financial institutions, the regulatory state essentially. So technically it could be done. Now there's two limitations. One is most people don't even know what that means, and if there's an awareness issue, fine, yes, of course. Let's say tomorrow everybody's aware about everybody's filing applications under that particular clause. The problem is that when you get into the whole system, then what has happened in a few cases where public-private partnerships have been asked for some information is that they will first refuse, then you go through the appellate process. When you go through the appellate process, eventually the final appellate authority, which is the Central Information Commission, in fact decreed and say deemed this is a public authority, the Delhi airport, for example. For XYZ reasons, it has this much amount of public money in it, government appointees, and it gives a whole rationale and says this is why this must be considered to be a public authority, and it must give out this information, which is rather innocent. It was about this person who wanted to know if there's going to be a little bit of path or land left for him to access the main road when this whole airport was being redeveloped through a PPP model. Very innocent and nothing particularly political. But they refused even after that, and they went to court. So then the moment you go into the court, now until then this court intervenes, but at least then we go back to the whole larger structural thing of the justice system. So now, right now the matter lies in the high courts. It'll probably go on there for several years, probably go to the Supreme Court because it becomes a pretty, you know. Meanwhile, the individual who has filed this the application, it does not have the same kind of staying power as a PPP with, you know, a few billions of small change and pocket change and below its belt. So we keep coming back to the same thing. I mean, essentially, we come full cycle that what are the structures of justice delivery, what are the systems, and even that will be finally an interpretation. Even let's say the matter goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, let's say, takes a decision that, the fight starts again, so to speak. Yes, of course, then we come back to the larger structure thing. Okay, that means we need to make new laws so that the Supreme Court is therefore duty-bound to actually implement those laws. We come back to... So these things are wonderfully and terribly, naughtily, you know, interrelated. But yes, there is a huge limitation. So far, I would say this is hardly been used either, definitely not in the Indian context. And... I don't know of too many celebrated cases in other parts of the world either.
Sorry, on that last point, when speaking about the provisions related to the RTI Act, it's generally viewed as a success amongst practitioners like those of us in the room as a means to access information. Towards the sort of dying days of the UPA2 government, there was a lot of conversation about amending the RTI Act, and, you know, from what I gather, the reason why it wasn't was because Sonia Gandhi's advisory committee basically really pushed back against the idea that it should be amended, and so it never really happened. So rather than the expansion of RTI to sort of carve out additional space for greater transparency and accountability, it seemed, at least at that period of time, that there was an attempt to encroach on whatever space had already been carved out, actually. And I'm just wondering, with the new government in place, whether you've heard whether there will be tinkering of the RTI Act, and if so, will it be regressive tinkering? Will it be progressive tinkering? Has there been any conversation about that?
I mean, there's some fears, of course, which have been expressed. For example, right now, there's no Chief Information Commissioner who hasn't been hired. Of course, there's a technical problem that the Chief Information Commissioner is appointed by a committee, and right now, there's no leader, which includes the leader of opposition. There is no leader of opposition. So there is this thing under which, behind which they are.
Sorry, there's no opposition.
Well, yes, because there's technically.
No, I'm
yeah,
exaggerating.
Sure. Yes,
no, yeah. Technically there is no leader of opposition,
of
right? In the parliament.
No, because there has to be 10%. They have to. The,
oh, really?
Yeah, in the by convention and by the past, the second largest the party which the leader of opposition must hold, that party must have at least 10% of seats in the House. And the second largest party does not even have that.
So there is that technicality through which is still being, you know, discussed and
set in your constitution.
It's not in the constitution. This is more sort of more parliamentary procedure, because the leader of our opposition is not necessarily a constitutional position, but it's become a more conventional convention where this and that person is accorded certain privileges and certain, and also through subsequent laws, a role in the appointments of certain positions, constitutional positions, such as the Chief Information Commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a complicated thing, but
democratic.
So there's all these checks and but you see, the point is amending. This is what I'm saying. I think in many ways, when we limit ourselves understanding to these processes only to the law itself, allow, you know, we can have the best of. You don't have to amend the law to kill it. You don't have to amend it. You just go slow. You just go slow. If the general message goes out, don't give out information, let it go into the appellate process, go out into the appellate, it goes into the appellate process. Meanwhile, it's a few years have passed. Most of the time, people require information which is required fairly quickly, immediately. Test the patients. There are several, don't hire information commissioners. Backlog can be for 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. So amending the law, I think, is a very, it's a very brash and a very banal tactic of actually doing something. There are many more clever ways of actually killing it. Right, already, I mean, because it's so popular, even with the fact that it's right now, so far in the last, 2005 now, it's 2014, 9 years or so, it's been so popular, but the sheer volume, I mean, it's just always about volumes in our country. It's always about volumes. I mean, the even very, very well-functioning information commissions where generally the central government level particularly, information is being given. Very, very small, minuscule percentage of cases is coming to the appellate process. But even there, I mean, it's swamped. I mean, you have backlogs right now of, you know, thousands and thousands of cases because you have 10 information commissioners. How many cases can they actually adjudicate in a single day? It's a lot. So it's, so there are ways of doing, like I said. So I think the new government, I don't know about what the new government's take on it, but what I'm saying is amending the law is going to be the necessarily, probably the least of it. That's not necessarily may or may not happen. But there are other forms in which if it could be killed, required. So that's not, and that's one has to, of course, you know, constantly talk about, you know, other systemic things and so on and so forth. And that's where we need to also look out beyond, I think. Is the idea to have a great law which is implemented well with no backlogs, or is the idea to have greater accountability and transparency? I think that's, again, something which we have to... Modi makes an interesting statement which was cheered yesterday, tremendously. I don't know if you caught that. So he said the last governments and all they talked about, we made this law, we have made that law. And I am talking about removing laws. Of course, what he's referring to is outdated laws from the British times, you know, a law like you can't parent to your neighbor if your neighbor is a Brit. I don't know, I'm kidding. But one of these obscure things or some ridiculous obscure things. So he's talking about removing laws. But the way he presented it was, he was saying, look, so that, you know, it's not only... He was basically mocking the previous government, saying that all they considered to be their achievements was the fact that they put new laws in place. Which, of course, they were talking about NREGA, Employment Guarantee, Right to Information, the Food Security Act, and Right to Education, which are some of these big legislations, which again, sort of rights-based legislation, which have been enacted. But at some level, I think there is a not so much of the fact of there's politics of other kind, but I think the whole obsession around that the be all and end all of any kind of social movement is to enact legislation, that's a very, very limited way of approaching social change. Very limited. We are one of the most over-legislated countries in the world. And look, what does that mean? I mean, you know, it's good that, not that it's not good, it's great that we have certain very, very progressive laws. Absolutely great. It's great that this particular on the issue of access to medicines and so on and so forth, some of the most progressive, and that's important, as particularly if we seek to be a regulatory state rather than a welfare state. Fine, yes, of course it's important. But that can't be the end. There's much, much larger processes and outcomes which we
have to look at where the law part is just is one piece of the puzzle.
So can I follow up on that, Prashant? I mean, in the larger project of bringing accountability to private sector and hybrid entities, is the what does your gut tell you about where resources should be directed? Is it a is it more about a set of cultural assumptions about protections that the private sector should be accorded, like the right to protect trade secrets, or the right generally of enterprises that are not publicly held to keep information about their operations closed to the public? Or does it have to do more with the set of assumptions about the private sector being more efficient than public sector, than the public sector? Is where are the points of attack? Where are the points of intervention? Is it a matter of undercutting and counteracting those cultural norms about rights that the private sector should supposedly hold? Or because I think you're right, and this is something we face in a number of different contexts, often the laws on the books are very good and give us all the tools to bring about transparency and accountability, but then there's a failure of implementation. And there's always some subset that says, well, it's a lack of political will. There are others who will say, well, it's a we need one more provision, one more tweaking of the law, and then we'll achieve what is it, what we seek. I'm just wondering what your instinct tells you is. I mean, it's very hard to bring about large-scale cultural shifts, but should advocacy be directed at changing attitudes toward the rights that the private sector should enjoy, or is that a kind of amorphous project that is unlikely to achieve very much success?
I wish I had clear answers to that. It's a very, very difficult question which you ask, of course. I mean, broadly, in tactical terms or in terms of in specific outcome terms, which are real and well defined, one of the things I think there is a certain sense of culture of impunity. You need to have something where perhaps certain, either when it's big examples or whatever, where it has to be the justice system which makes an example, which has to say that, you know, you can be big, but you can't, you can be whatever, but look, if you're going to transgress the laws, I don't think it's a question of, I think the laws are very nice. I mean, there's some very good laws which do put certain restrictions on the private sector and the corporate entities. Not that they're not there, but they are interpreted, or there's a whole politics around that. Fundamentally, first thing, I think this is the whole culture of impunity has to be that you will be held accountable for your actions. That must come from the justice system, first and foremost. Message goes out, a much larger message, that nobody is sort of, you know, that kind of above, like these last few judgments which the Supreme Court has come up with, which are very good, which send out a message. The last 10 years, the Supreme Court was sending out a lot of messages through its decisions on political actors, politicians, which continues now. So, for example, a big leading politician was also put behind bars. Chief Minister of the state of Tamil Nadu, 60 million people, extremely popular. So there are these things, but now I think increasingly there are many more judgments, which are also then being reported by the media as well, which is sort of, so I think that's good. Although there's another story, the corporatization of media, but that's another story. And the second thing is, I think, in the end, why, and that is something I think which is actually, in terms of real things, in terms of how these processes work eventually, which we have to get a handle on, is political finance. Invariably, we have to, that's where it keeps coming back to. The whole thing of how are political entities, political parties, political actors, this whole thing of whether it's campaign finance or where, how does those money flows take place, and how can those money flows essentially either be held to account? Because in the end, whether it's lawmaking or whether how the laws are operated or whether it's impunity or non-impunity in all of these things, is that relationship, that financial or that relationship which impacts everything. Because that will have an impact on the political, that will have an impact on everything. Until that's where the I think the core or heart of the matter in this kind of political system where there are certain democratic procedures in place, at the very least. And of course, the third thing has to be at the level of people, I would say. In the sense, I mean, until unless that particular, now there is a great expectation in the public thing of, impatience rather, that certain behavior, certain kind of thing is not going to be tolerated as it used to be. When will that be extended to big corporate leaders as well, there needs to be some level of public, what's the naming of sharing, but that whole thing, public expectation has to be of a certain kind which cannot be ignored. And that's at a much more diffuse level. I mean, that's at the more diffuse level, I would say. But and the other two, I would say, are the more specific things in terms of specific frameworks or specific actions or activities which could be focused on. But it's going to be tough. That's really it, I suppose.
Great. Well, I think, does this sound like we've come to any other questions, thoughts, comments?
We could continue with a beer at the end of the
Well, thank you for all of you for your questions, comments, and Prashant, I know that we're all eager to see what this next year brings and the work that you do, and it'll be really interesting to see how this goes forward. But I think just a lot of interesting takeaways for all of us involved in the work.
Thank you, Shubhana, and thank you for this wonderful opportunity and interactions.
Thank you.
Thank you.